Okay, my name is John Beck, and with my friend and colleague Kurt Hurst, I co-direct our daily work, Our Daily Lives. So let me just make announcements and then introduce today's speaker and today's topic. Might be good if I actually did what I'm supposed to do, a variety of ways. The obligatory sign and sheets, please sign in. So I'll just start one of those with Phil, and it can go around. Next Friday, we're back at the MSU Library. And we're there because of the fact that the colloquial series over there, colloquia series, is co-sponsoring Dennis Stromat, who's going to be talking about French Creole music and language from the Missouri Mines, 1723 to 2008. Small span of time, but we hope that music. Dennis is one of the most accomplished of the kind of Cajun fiddlers in the United States, and I think that you would have a lot of fun and do come to that. So you can either take the green one, which is from the library, or the white one, which is from me. So Phil, those are coming to you.
But you can listen to him play that evening, too.
Oh, yes. That evening, he'll be playing at So you get to see him at noon, talking about the evolution of that music and everything else, and you're going to be able to see him perform at night. Now, I'm going to hand these out. This is the rest. This is actually the entire spring schedule, but there's two changes. So what I'll do is I'll simply hand those around first and then mention what those changes are so that you might capture them. The first change is I'll give you that the last talk of our series this spring, on April 19th, Wage Slaves and Radicals Writing People's History of the 1913-14 Michigan Copper Strike, that is not going to be in this room. That is going to be over at the library, and we're co-sponsoring that with the Library Colloquia series. And interestingly enough, is my friend Phil Schertzing, of Michigan policing well, the 1913 Michigan Copper Strike echoes what Gary is going to be talking about today in terms of the Pennsylvania State Police, because it was really the 1913 Copper Strike that was one of the great impetuses to actually have a state police force, and so I'm sure that all of you would be quite interested in that. But I have to tell you that if you remember rightly, on Thursday, February 21st, I turned many of you away because John Basler from the History Department of Saginaw Valley was sick that day. Well, we rescheduled him, and he is speaking on April 11th. So Thursday, April 11th, he's coming here to do that talk, Disciplining the Inaccurate Instrument of Intimidation, Organized Labor's Campaign Against the Polygraph, 1965 to 88. So please do come back at that point. One last announcement is that we have a brand new Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives actual exhibit that is opening downstairs and will run from Tax Day, April 15th, to June 15th. And it's called Sun Up to Sundown, selections from the Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives collection. So both two-dimensional and three-dimensional art, much of it by workers or insider art, and that will be in the foyer, and it will leak around both sides. If you've been downstairs, you've seen the Mark Priest, the Iron Man, which is back up on the wall. That's part of that exhibit, and there'll be a number of things in the cases as well that I think I would commend to you as an interesting exhibit. Some very famous names in terms of art, Clementine Hunter, one of the greatest of the self-taught African-American artists in U.S. history. Ralph Fasanella will actually have two Fasanellas on the wall. And a wonderful painting called Yuri Shop by Andrew Reeder, who was a student here and is now an art professor at Saginaw Valley. So with that, let me switch over to talking about my wonderful friend Gary Jones and what he's going to be talking about today. Gary and I first met here at Michigan State when he came here for a conference on radicalism that was sponsored by the Journal for the Study of Radicalism, which is a journal here at Michigan State. And we've gotten together on other occasions at other conferences, and he's an unbelievably talented historian. He currently teaches history at American International College in Massachusetts. Prior to that, he was at Muhlenberg College in Pennsylvania. He finished his PhD working under Roger Simon at Lehigh University, where he also did his master's. And prior to that, he finished his bachelor's degree in his home country at the University of Kent in Great Britain. Gary said many of you might have heard him talk about his desire now to become a citizen of the United States. So he'll have to watch out what he says today, because this could go into the file, and who knows how the authorities will take it. But Gary's been doing some very, very interesting work on policing and how policing has an effect on the labor movement, and I think to a great degree vice versa. And today he'll be talking on his research, and the title of his talk is Russia and America, Cossacks in Pennsylvania, the Department of State Police, and Early 20th Century Conflict in the Coal Fields. So please help me in welcoming Gary Jones to our daily work at Daily Lab.
Thank you. Well, what I'll try to do today actually is, one, not talk for too long, but long enough, and try to do, I guess, two things in a way. Number one is give you some background on the formation of the Pennsylvania Department of State Police, formation, organization, how it operated. But number two actually is, so that's sort of more general, but number two is to talk more specifically about, in actual fact, one incident in one of the strikes in the coalfields that the state police actually policed during their first months of going on active duty in the spring of 1906. And I'm going to try, that's going to be the strategy, and hopefully I can integrate the two things and not take too long. But also because I was just reviewing, actually looking at, a really good book from a couple of years ago, Stephen Norwood, on strike breaking in America. And he talks about various forms of strike breaking, and he's got a chapter on Cossacks in the coalfields, where he talks not just about the state police in Pennsylvania, but all sorts of different types of police that were seen as Cossacks in the coalfields of America. And I was reading that, and it's a very interesting and impressive chapter, as it is a book. But I thought it might be nice to talk about, rather than to talk generally about Cossacks in the coalfield, to talk about one specific incident, and try and put some of their conduct, behavior, operation in a sort of a context. So I guess I'm going for the sort of parachutist and the truffle hunter, and try to sort of join them in the middle. But more generally, to begin with the state police, the formation of the state police, it was in Pennsylvania in 1905. They go on active duty in 1906. It's the first in the nation and the model, for subsequent forces. And, I would argue it's the major institutional response, policy response of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to, the emergence of corporate capitalism at the time in Pennsylvania in the early 1900s. And it plays a key role in the consolidation of corporate capitalism. And its origins lie in class conflict, and in particular, in class conflict in the corporate sector of the economy, and in particular in coal, and in particular in the anthracite coal industry. And a series of strikes that occurs in the 1890s, especially 1900 and 1902, which ends, of course, with the Roosevelt's intervention and the Anthracite Coal Commission. The report of the Anthracite Coal Commission, and this is the sort of shortened version of all this, which recommends, one of its recommendations is that the Coal and Iron Police, private police, be replaced by a new state police force. What happens is that the Republican governor, Samuel Pennypacker, takes up this recommendation, and the following in January 1906, recommends in his message to the Assembly that a state police force be created to replace the Coal and Iron Police and alleviate the National Guard of strike duty. The National Guard had been called out at least 5 times in 10 years, twice in its entirety, 3 times in its entirety, excuse me. And it was very expensive. So what happens is legislation is introduced to the Assembly that year. It's 1905. And the debate over the bill did not focus on the nature of the new force to be created. It focused on what impact would the new force have on the Coal and Iron Police, the current and future status of the Coal and Iron Police. And basically what happens is the bill works its way through the legislature, but its passage, its sort of pathway to being passed and signed into law by the governor does not become clear until it's clear to the coal carrying railroads, the coal operators, especially in anthracite, that had large numbers of Coal and Iron Police in their employ, until it becomes clear that the new state police force will supplement, not replace, the Coal and Iron Police. And then the bill is passed through the legislature. Even then, it nearly failed. It nearly failed. But if it wasn't the governor's pet measure, it would have failed. It was supported by the Republican state machine. It was opposed by rural Republicans, Democrats, the newly reconstituted and small State Federation of Labor, and the State Grange. Interestingly, the miners' lobby from the UMW stayed neutral because they had other bills pending in that legislature, and Mitchell and those around him did not, because it was the governor's pet measure, they did not want to alienate the governor, right? Once the state police goes on active duty, that position is swiftly reversed, right? But it's too late by then, you know. Actually, as the Pennsylvania Federation of Labor later concluded, with an institution like the state police, I think they concluded, once it's established, it's difficult to disestablish. It was impossible to repeal the act which created the state police. They've been on active duty since March of 1906. So the bill is signed into law by the governor. The governor appoints the first superintendent, John C. Groom, a Philadelphia Republican, member of the National Guard, been to Homestead, been in coal strikes, fought in the Spanish-American War, and he really creates the Pennsylvania State Police. He takes the act which created the force, which was a very short, simple act, and it's how he interprets that act that creates the force. In actual fact, in 1906, he publicly stated, he called it a damn fool law, because it was so short and gave so little guidance. On the other hand, it allowed him to create the force that he really wanted to create. So what he did was, the force was to be 228 men strong. He divided into 4 troops. The young men he hired were all former soldiers or National Guardsmen, and they were to be uniformed, armed, and mounted, according to Groom, at all times. So their arms or weapons, I would say, would be their horse, a 38 revolver, a horse, a riot stick, a 38 revolver, and a Springfield carbine. And I would say they used them in that order, that the horse wasn't just transportation, it was also a weapon. And he divided them, they were divided into 4 troops, 2 in the east, 2 in the west. In the west, it would be Greensburg, Westmoreland County, and Butler County. And in the east, it would be Wyoming, Luzerne County, and Pottsville, Schuylkill County. And what would happen was, once they went on duty, part of each troop would patrol each day on horseback in the surrounding area. But what would happen, you see, is that if need be, each troop, a detachment from each troop, or each troop, or 2 troops, or 3 or 4, could be deployed anywhere in the state within hours by railroad, taking their horses, later on by truck. And once deployed, they could stay on duty for weeks, months, even years. All right, by rotating the troops, they could police an ongoing strike, a prolonged strike. When they were on duty, the state police had the maximum powers, broadest duties, and largest jurisdiction that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania could bestow. In other words, they had powers, the same powers as policemen of the cities of the first class. They're authorized, the most important power is they're authorized to and empowered to make arrests without warrant for all violations of law that they witnessed. And they could execute warrants, of course, issued by the proper local authorities. And their duties, they were to cooperate with local authorities. And sometimes there were problems there because the local authorities, you know, didn't want the cooperation of the state police. But their duties were to detect crime, apprehend criminals, and preserve law and order throughout the state. and this was a notable innovation, not invention, but innovation in policing in America. Notable, significant, very controversial. So much so that when the Industrial Commission met and was holding its hearings in 1915, the superintendent and the deputy superintendent were summoned to testify before the commission, and they did so under duress, and they took a lawyer with them, because some of the commissioners basically grilled them, and they knew a grilling was coming when they came to give testimony, and about the origins and creation and organization and operation of the state police force. And in their defense, Groom argued that the time given to strike duty by the force was the equivalent of one day per man per year. However, he also immediately noted that in the time from 1906 to 1915, the state police had, on 9 or 10 occasions, had relieved the Pennsylvania National Guard of performing strike duty. The occasions he listed were anthracite and bituminous coal in 1906, the Chester streetcar strike of 1908, McKees Rocks 1909, Philadelphia streetcar strike in 1910, bituminous coal strike of 1910 to 11, anthracite 1912, Erie iron molder strike of 1913, and the Wilkes-Barre streetcar strike of 1915. So it seems, on the one hand, he's trying to minimize that, he says, the amount of time and manpower devoted to policing strikes, and on the other hand, he lists 9 or 10 major strikes where the National Guard would have been, he argued, would have been called out if it wasn't for the operation of the state police. And when it came, he was asked about the attitude of the institution to strikes and policing strikes. And when questioned about that, he said officially, we don't recognize strikes or strikers. He said officially, we recognize sort of peace or riot. And in times of peace, citizens have rights and liberties. In times of riot, they do not. The deputy superintendent, Lum, the Groom was the superintendent, he also gave testimony, and he said workers had a, quote, perfect right to strike, but, quote, no right to interfere with another who was not on strike. And he said that, quote, in time of riot, there are no innocent bystanders, end of quote. And it was the duty of every citizen to retire to their home. And he added that, rather ominously, that he thought there was a spirit of anarchy in the labor movement, that it was undermining its correct attitude to law and order. So ostensibly, they don't recognize strikes and strikers. It's a question of, you know, for them, it's I guess, the strike riot or riots and rioters. And simply, they were to restore law and order when deployed during a strike. And, I mean, over time, the training and instructions, I guess, of the state police became more elaborate and complex. After World War I, when the force was expanded, and they set up a training school at Hershey, and the new state policemen would take a series of lectures about the different aspects of police work. And one of them was on crowds, mobs, and riots, which they were taught often occur in the context of labor disturbances. And the lecturer went on to explain the relationship between a crowd, a mob, and a riot, and how and why they needed to be efficiently policed. Efficiency was a really important concept and word with the state police. The state police, their definition of a crowd was three or more people that are gathered together, not for a peaceable purpose. And the lecturer argues, that a crowd could develop into a mob and riot at any moment All they needed was mass indignation and a natural leader, right? So therefore, for the state police, the time to disperse a crowd is before it becomes a mob and riots, while it hesitates. What the state policeman should do is you disperse the crowd, and you do that by you apply force, and these are mounted state policemen, apply force on the flank of the crowd, and you drive towards the center of the crowd, and that's how you disperse them. And they said, identify and overcome the leaders, who they said could be located by their demeanor and action. Once you get the leaders, the rest of the crowd will disperse. And again, in the lecture, it says, literally says, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but also giving you sort of direct quotes, for the purpose of dispersing a crowd, the horse was your, quote, best weapon. That's why I say the horse, we shouldn't overlook the horses. It's fundamental. And the lecturer concluded before, actually, there were a series of study questions for the new state policeman about the lecture, that it's a matter of history that five state policemen acting together as a unit could disperse a crowd or mob of over 1,000, right? So they are an efficient force, which for some could be celebrated, for others would be a condemnation. And they had some powerful and influential supporters within the state and beyond. One of the most famous was Theodore Roosevelt, of course, former police commissioner himself of New York City. In the preface to a book by Catherine Mayo, Justice to All, The Story of the Pennsylvania State Police, he wrote that the state police was a model of efficiency. Actually, I remember reading Jim Maurer, the Pennsylvania Socialist autobiography, It Can Be Done, and he had a great line about Theodore Roosevelt and the state police. He said, Roosevelt loved uniforms, which I think was a good one. And Catherine Mayo, in this book, Mounted Justice, The Story of the Pennsylvania State Police, it was the first of three books she wrote about the state police. It was actually written with the full cooperation and collaboration of the state police force itself, the superintendent, the officers, the enlisted men, and the royalties from the book went to a fund for retired members of the state police force. Actually, there was a UMW assemblyman who, and the subject of this book came up for debate in the legislature, and he was from Luzerne and Lackawanna, and he stood up and said, and I like this one too, who is Catherine Mayo and what was she paid? That was a good one too, but the way some people like Mayo and Roosevelt perceived the state police was as this sort of model of efficiency, sort of of efficiency, discipline, and honor. Of course, if you spoke to Jim Maurer or other, Pennsylvania labor leaders or the rank and file or the working class, you'd get a very different response. Interestingly, a bill was passed in 1911 which gave a pay raise to the enlisted men, the only pay raise they got from 1905 till 1917, not to the officers. And it also reorganized the force. And the superintendent, Groom, actually, after this, in the process of reorganizing the force, administratively reorganizing it, sent out a memo to the four captains of each troop, with item numbering, enumerating things that needed to change. And one of those items, in actual fact, was this. Excuse me. The use of clubs or blackjacks on individuals, especially during labor riots, has been entirely too reckless and with utter disregard for the rights of the citizens on the public highways. The practice must be discontinued. Right? And now the working class and the labor movement in Pennsylvania wouldn't have been surprised, by that. From the time the state police went on active duty and began policing strikes in March 1906, when contracts in the anthracite and bituminous industries were about to expire, right? Simultaneously for the first time, their response, I would say, was immediate and unanimous. I mean, they condemn the force in the strongest possible terms. And rhetorically as well. I mean, this is why they say they're Cossacks. Russia in America, Cossacks in Pennsylvania. I mean, ostensibly, in a democratic Republican and a democratic republic, the Cossack style of policing and Cossacks have no place. In actual fact, William Z. Foster updated that in his book about the steel strike after World War I, and he compared the state police Cossacks as, bringing about a wave of terror, white terrorism, of course, alluding to the civil war in Russia after World War One, and that they had sort of basically, they were the perpetrators of, I think he used the phrase, scientific barbarism or barbarity. I would have said brutal efficiency. But so he updates this sort of critique, saying they're like, you know, the white Russians. But the workers, in actual fact, you know, organized or unorganized, reject the state police immediately. They don't see them as a legitimate force. And, you know, when the state police are policing a strike, from the perspective of the workers, they were literally under attack and they defended themselves. And it's quite well known, I'm talking about the Industrial Commission of 1915, Big Bill Hayward, testified as well. And he famously states that during the McKeesrock strike of 1909, the immigrant workers themselves and the Wobblies warned the state police, you kill one of us, we'll kill one of you. Jim Maurer also testified to the Industrial Commission of 1915, and he actually told the Industrial Commission that, and what's interesting is this is less well known. I mean, Maurer was a socialist, of course. But he said he's sick and tired of seeing Pennsylvania workers stand up and get attacked and injured and killed, and we should, you know, organize and train and fight back. And he's asked about that at the subsequent Pennsylvania Federation of Labor annual meeting, and he stood by it. He didn't retract one word, didn't move one inch. He said, I meant what I said, and, you know, and I'll say it again. But of course, one of the differences between Hayward and Maurer is Hayward is a socialist, not a Wobbly, and Hayward was also a three or four time assemblyman from Reading, Pennsylvania, to the state assembly, and he becomes president of the Federation of Labor, long time president of the Pennsylvania Federation of Labor, and he really organizes, in some ways, an effective campaign, not completely effective, but an effective campaign against the state police. What happens is that's why when they go on active duty in 1906 through to 1917, they only got one pay raise, because the State Federation of Labor, Pennsylvania Federation of Labor, fought any increase in wages or salaries for the enlisted men or the officers. They also fought legislation and successfully defeated legislation to expand the force, because the governors and the superintendent, as soon as the force is organized and goes on operation, they want to expand it. For them, this, you know, it's a model of efficiency. It's an experiment, a successful experiment, and they want to expand it. But the Pennsylvania legislature would meet every other year. What happened was the State Federation of Labor tries to repeal the act which created it in 1907 and fails. But from 1909, 1911, 1913, 1915, they were able to limit the force to one pay raise and to stop any expansion of the force. They failed, though, as I say, to abolish it. Then they tried to reform its personnel, right? Then they tried to regulate its duties, and they fail in all of that. This is why they come to the conclusion that once established, it's difficult to disestablish such an institution. But to Roosevelt and Catherine Mayo, it's a model of efficiency. Another description that the State Federation of Labor offered about the state police was, and this was a good one, was it's the best yet invented strike-breaking institution. This is somewhat in the way of giving you some background about the force. And what I want to do now is actually sort of switch gears and I guess go back to 1906, which is March 1906, March, April, May 1906. It's the first year the force has gone on active duty. Groom organized it from 1905 to 1906. And for the first time in Pennsylvania, the contracts in the bituminous fields and the anthracite fields were going to expire at the same time, in actual fact. And there was a possibility of, industry-wide strikes in bituminous and anthracite coal, hard and soft coal, at the same time, which would have given could have given the UMW and the mine workers tremendous leverage in the negotiations. And many of the rank and file among the miners in Pennsylvania wanted that to be the strategy and the tactic. John Mitchell, of course, a very conservative but very powerful president of the UMW, he actually separated the negotiations, and therefore the likelihood of having two strikes at once, you know, sort of disappeared. What followed in anthracite was what he called a work stoppage, right? They were negotiating and couldn't come to agreement, so there's a work suspension. Somehow that was different to a strike. And what happened in bituminous coal, and there was ultimately, in anthracite, there was an industry-wide settlement. In bituminous coal, what happened was there was a series of actual strikes, but Mitchell and the UMW let the districts actually negotiate separate settlements with each sort of coal company or even colliery. So this is the first time they go on active duty. As I said, they've been on active duty ever since. So they, you know, they were involved in multiple incidents in both coal fields, anthracite and bituminous, in 1906. In anthracite, they'd be involved again in 1912, 1916, and on. And in the bituminous coal fields, they would be involved in strikes. A notable one would be 1910 to 12. So what I'd like to do is, but rather than sort of talk generally about sort of the state police, explicitly anyway, about in both anthracite and bituminous, I'm actually going to sort of, I guess this is the truffle hunting bit, talk about 1906 and anthracite and one specific incident where the state police, the first time the state police were called to the Schuylkill field, the southernmost anthracite coal field. And this involves both Troop C and Troop B, the two that were stationed in the eastern part of the state. And what happened was, at that time, I should add, one of the troops was stationed at Wyoming, Luzerne County. The other one initially was stationed, its barracks was in Redding, Berks County. And interestingly, after 1906, that troop is moved, its barracks is moved, a move from Redding, Berks County, to Pottsville, Schuylkill County, after this 1906. And what happens is the negotiations go nowhere between Mitchell and the anthracite operators, you know, the five or six coal carrying railroads that dominate the anthracite coal trade. The negotiations are going nowhere, and on April 2nd, 1906, a work suspension begins. That's what Mitchell and the UMW call it. And what happens is, in early April, Groom decides to send Troop C from Redding, Berks County, on a tour of the coal fields. And they, on horseback, they ride from Redding to the coal fields. And when they get to the coal fields, they split up, and half the troop goes to Tamarqua. The other half heads towards Pottsville. And they arrive in Pottsville on April the 30th. And the Miners' Journal the next day had a big headline and an article on the arrival of the state police for the first time in Pottsville. And this is April 30th in the Miners' Journal. And the headline said, "Constabulary troop invades our region." The journalist went on to say, to describe the arrival of the constabulary. It's the first time they've been to Pottsville. And he says, they arrived covered with a thick layer of dust. They presented rather a disappointing appearance, but after brushing up, they appeared a pretty neat set of fellows after all, who succeeded in getting a sign of recognition from some of the coquettish girls, who a few hours before hurled all sorts of anathemas at them. And then the article went on and said, observing the constables as they rode up Center Street, one could not fail to notice that they are prepared to do business if there is provocation enough to engage them. And then he talked about the appearance of them. And he says, the whole uniform is substantial in material as well as effect. It is serviceable and impressive and clothes the wearer with the respect due a representative of the state's executive. And then he went on to say, but the constabulary was not dependent on the uniform alone to carry the majesty of the law against the turbulent classes. Each constable carried a Colt 38 strapped to his hip, this is the journalist, a 2-inch thick locust stick, meaning a riot stick, on the pommel of their saddle, a Springfield carbine, and 100 rounds of ammunition. And he goes on and he says, the journalist had interviewed the lieutenant in charge of the troop, right? This detachment of Troop C. And he said, the lieutenant informed the journalist that he had no orders with regard to the future movement of the troop, although he expected orders from Groom during the day. And the lieutenant informed the Miners Journal journalist that the troopers are not looking for trouble and hope to be able to avoid it. However, this is more ominous, and this is, I think, is a really interesting quote, really, lovely quote. He said they'd been ordered to the coal regions to become acquainted with the public highways and, quote, to impress the public with the might of the state for quelling disorder should the contingency arise. You know, that caught my eye, you know, years ago, sitting there looking at the microfilm, you know, suddenly woke up when I read that. Well, that you're probably surprised, the contingency soon arose, right? In the spring of 1906, the Lehigh Valley Railroad was sinking a new colliery, they called it the Sayer Colliery, outside of Mount Carmel, Northumberland County, right? About a mile outside of the borough of Mount Carmel. And the shaft was being sunk and the breaker was being built, and then the UMW called the work suspension. But the Lehigh Valley Railroad wanted to continue work on the shaft and the breaker, and they intended, when it was completed, to operate during the work suspension and what everyone thought was going to be the strike that would follow the work suspension. Now, to be fair, I'm not entirely sure myself what's the difference between a work suspension and a strike, right? But Mitchell was calling it a work suspension and no one was working. Now, the local miners, on April 28th, the local miners who had obeyed were obeying the work suspension, they held a meeting and they decided to picket the colliery to stop work on the shaft and the breaker, right? I think it's really, maybe they were getting technical with this, but it was the work on the shaft they really objected to. That's actual mining, right? Rather than building the breaker. And the superintendent of the Lehigh Valley Railroad hears about this and he contacts the sheriff of the county, the local burgess, the vice president of the United Mine Workers, and he's trying to say, hey, don't picket, right? But he doesn't get, of course, that's not what happens. They are intending to picket. And that evening, when the workers who are digging the shaft, mining the shaft, and building the breaker, they leave to go back to Mount Carmel where they lived, right? It's less than a mile from the from the colliery into the Mount Carmel. Of course, there's a crowd, there's shouting, there's stone throwing, there are gunshots. And one of the workers gets shot in the hand, right? Which is no little thing. And what happens is the next day, on Sunday, April 29th, the superintendent learned that that was a Saturday. On the Sunday, the 29th, he learns that on Monday morning, they're going to picket the colliery again, right? And the superintendent and now the general manager contact the county sheriff, and they want a guarantee, and this would happen again and again, they want a guarantee our workers and our property are safe, right? Which the sheriffs couldn't really give. And as a result, the superintendent pressures the sheriff to request the aid of the new state constabulary. And he does that reluctantly, right? Now, the coal company had already directly, Lehigh Valley Railroad had already directly contacted J.C. Groom, right? Who is the superintendent. Now, the headquarters of the state police is in the Capitol building at Harrisburg. J.C. Groom actually resided in Philadelphia, and the deputy superintendent actually ran the headquarters day to day. He had he came from a wealthy family who had iron and steel interests, but he actually ran a business that imported fine wines, right? And he would be kept up to date by the deputy superintendent. And Groom immediately agrees that the state constabulary should go to Mount Carmel. Troop C boarders a special train from the Pennsylvania Railroad and is deployed to Mount Carmel. And the troopers arrive, they and their horses arrive at Mount Carmel in the early hours of Monday, April 30th. This is 1906, the very early hours. I was gonna say that it seems like they always come at dawn, right? But now no crowds had gathered in Mount Carmel. There'd been no rioting. The Burgess had not requested the presence of the state police constabulary, you know, in Mount Carmel itself. But what happens is when the state police arrive, you know, they disembark from the train, they take their horses off, they get on their horses, and they patrol the streets of Mount Carmel. Sometimes it's hard not to be sarcastic, isn't it? But, you know, no doubt they're trying to, as the lieutenant had said earlier, impress the citizens with the might of the state to quell disorder, right? But in actual fact, the arrival, presence, and conduct of the state police has the opposite effect. It exacerbates or provokes disorder. Because what happened was the Burgess, the miners, the citizens are incensed by the arrival of the state police, and they're patrolling the borough. And it's not just that they patrolled the borough, it's the way they did it, according to later witnesses, right? Because according to eyewitnesses, the troopers galloped through the streets, rode their horses onto the sidewalks, insulted the residents, including their wives and daughters. And Norwood and others would argue that that was very often a strategy or a tactic by all sorts of policemen in the coal fields to provoke tension and conflict. I guess what Mother Jones would have called drama, right? Insult the wives and daughters or threaten them in some way, right? And that was actually an Alfred Garner, who was actually a state assemblyman, a Republican from nearby Schuylkill County. He'd actually been in Mount Carmel early that morning, but had apparently left before the state police arrived, but he spoke to the residents of Mount Carmel, whom ostensibly he trusted, and later on in 1907, when they're debating whether to introduce a bill to repeal the act which created the state police, he says to the legislature, had he been the recipient of such behavior, he says, damn, I would have thrown bullets, not stones, right? Now, it gives you a clue to what happens, because stones start to fly, right? And not to give the game away, but bullets start to fly as well, right? What happens, see, it's still Monday morning, early Monday morning, after patrolling the streets of the borough, maybe this is no surprise too, the state police leave Mount Carmel and they ride their horses 3/4 of a mile, guess where? Sayer Colliery. All right, and again, not to give the game away, right, but this is where they made their mistake, and I've never come across this mistake again in studying the state police during the Progressive Era, right? Because what actually happens is they stable their horses at the Sayer Colliery, and they stable their horses, and they marched on foot, right, back into Mount Carmel, right? And what they want, of course, is breakfast, right? They want breakfast, and they go from hotel to hotel, and no one will serve them. The cooks won't cook them, the waitresses won't serve them, the newsies wouldn't even sell them a newspaper, right? Finally, they end up at the commercial hotel, and there the cooks and the waitresses don't want to cook and serve for them. Finally, someone agrees to make them breakfast, and they have breakfast. So they're delayed. So what happens? They come out of the hotel, a crowd has gathered, right? And they're on foot, right? And what happens is the jeering starts, the shouting starts, the stones start to fly, right? Now, what happens is the lieutenant immediately orders the troopers, the state police, to charge the crowd. And they have brought their sticks with them, you know. So I guess in that sense, they've got their sidearms and their nightsticks. And as a result, several people were injured, including one man who received a fractured skull. And he was taken to hospital. And the state police arrest two men, and they take them to the local JP's office. And the constabulary presses charges against these two men. Of course, the miners also pressed charges against the constabulary, and a hearing was set for Tuesday morning. And then the lieutenant and the troopers, they begin to march back to Sayer Colliery, right? Now, what happens is the crowd forms again, and the jeering starts again, and the stones fly again. And now, more seriously, this time, the lieutenant doesn't tell them to charge the crowd and use their nightsticks. This time, he orders them to fire. Right, and they fire into the crowd, and 14 individuals were shot. 7 of them were wounded seriously. 11 of those shot were immigrant miners. The remaining 3 were Americans, were spectators. Now, that some of the state police were injured, but in contrast to the kind of injuries the miners got from bullets, two state policemen were injured from stones. Right, from stones, and they weren't injured seriously. And then after this incident, the second incident that morning, they finally get back to the Sayer Colliery, which incidentally has a wooden stockade built around it, which was rather convenient. and they remain in the stockade. And what happens at this point is the county sheriff, John Sharpless, a farmer, arrives at Sayre Colliery. And despite repeated requests from Lieutenant Smith, Sharpless refused to deputize the troopers and ordered them to stay out of Mount Carmel. And the sheriff is the senior law enforcement official in any county, right? And then the sheriff left the colliery and the vicinity of Mount Carmel, in actual fact, and he didn't really want anything to do with this controversy. You know, as we would have said back home, he didn't want to touch it with a barge pole, right? He actually traveled around Northumberland County and the surrounding area to avoid getting involved again in this incident. He got the nickname Flying John, because he tried to keep moving and they'd never catch him and he'd never have to be involved. He's a farmer. He's been elected sheriff. This is a very controversial incident. He, you know, whatever stance he takes, he's going to, alienate voters. He wants nothing to do with it. And what does a farmer know about policing, you know, this unprecedented wave of class conflict, right? But what happens is Groom actually sends the remainder of Troop C, right, to the Sayre Colliery and Troop B. So by the end of the evening, half of the new state police force is in Sayre Colliery, right? 124 men, right? As Mother Jones would say, there's a lot of drama and tension and conflict. The next morning, stuffed dummies were found hung from the telegraph poles, indicating what the miners would like to do to the state policemen, right? The UMW steps in, and Paul Pulaski, the vice president of the district, and himself a resident of Mount Carmel, actually, he establishes pickets to keep the miners away from the colliery, right, to prevent any contact and further conflict. What the UMW said was, okay, you can work on the, their compromise was you can work on the breaker, but not the shaft, right? And the local leaders of the UMW, they have warrants sworn out against the troopers. The trouble is they've got to serve them, right? So the serving of those warrants will have to wait. And from behind the stockade surrounding the colliery, the constabulary postponed the hearings, the hearings for the two men that they had arrested. And what happens is the officers in charge of the state police, the two captains and lieutenants at the colliery, they're trying to get in contact with Flying John, right? The farmer sheriff, and they want him to deputize the constabulary, the members of the constabulary, and they want him to give them permission to enter Mount Carmel, right? And the sheriff refuses both requests, right? And he quite rightly says, if you go into Mount Carmel, it's going to create more disorder, further disturbance. The Burgess of Mount Carmel as well, actually, he contacted the constabulary at the colliery and ordered them to stay outside of the borough. The officers in charge, you see, they say, look, we've got to protect these workers when they're going to and from the colliery, to their homes, back to their homes in the borough. We've got to enter the borough. But the Burgess says, no, you're not coming into the borough. And the Burgess actually contacts the superintendent, Groom, at home in Philadelphia. And Groom concedes that, okay, they won't enter the borough, right? They'll remain outside the borough. But Groom at the time publicly expressed his feelings and thoughts about this work suspension and about Mount Carmel. And he said that he was confident that his officers and men could handle the matter in what he called a judicious manner, i.e. they would get the leaders responsible for the attack on the state police and land them in jail. And he added that, some people are protesting against the actions of my men, yet there is a state of affairs existing in some parts of the state that would not be tolerated in any civilized country on the globe. I am told every foreigner and the disturbers of the peace in the coal regions are all foreigners, has a revolver and a stick of dynamite. Moreover, the superintendent was, quote, as yet unable to determine the difference between suspension of work and a strike, but the foreigners seem to be able to shoot and beat up just as many during the former as in a regular strike, And the governor, not surprisingly, shared the superintendent's views in actual fact. You know, what's the difference between a work suspension and a strike? And what's the difference between a strike and a riot, right? And he issues a proclamation on May the 2nd, which sort of sounds more like the age of Lincoln than the age of Roosevelt, right? He says, Every man is entitled to labor and to get for his labor the highest compensation he can lawfully secure. There is no law to compel him to labor unless he chooses to, and he may cease to labor whenever he considers it to be in his interest or so to cease. The laboring man out of whose effort wealth arises has the sympathy of all disinterested people in his lawful struggles to rescue a larger proportion of the profit which results from his labor. What he earns belongs to him, and if he invests his earnings, the law protects his property, just as the rights of property of all men must be protected. But he went on and he said, he has no right to interfere with another man who may want to labor. Violence has no place amongst us and will not be tolerated. And he concluded the proclamation by calling on all men to keep the peace with the knowledge that it is the purpose of the Commonwealth to see that the principles herein outlined are enforced. And with the state police force, he's got an efficient instrument, an efficient force to do that. So Pennypacker is determined to assert the authority and power of the Commonwealth. And Groom is determined to assert the authority of this new state police force. So what they do actually, what they do is over the local authorities in actual fact, and they order, Groom orders the officers not to surrender, if warrants are served on them, don't surrender to the local authorities, and he orders them to patrol the borough and the surrounding area and arrest anyone who was involved in the two events on the morning of Monday, April 30th. So in the following days, the constabulary patrolled the borough again, and they ride through, and what they're doing is looking at faces and scrutinizing faces, and then they arrest any minors that they remember seeing involved in the two incidents from the Monday morning. And the minors were arrested, they didn't resist, and they were actually detained indefinitely without trial at the Sayer Colliery, right? Now, this is not Coeur d'Alene and Idaho in the 1890s, but it's this, in principle, it's the same, you know? And of course, by detaining those arrested, the constabulary is exceeding its power and violating their rights of those arrested. And a local justice of the peace went to the district attorney and tried to get him to compel the state police to arraign the individuals they'd arrested and detained before the appropriate civil authorities. Now, it might be that the local justices of the peace were sympathetic to the coal miners and the state police didn't want to take them to the local GP because the local GP would let them off, right? They wouldn't be held for trial. And the justice of the peace publicly stated that the state police is exceeding its authority. Its acts are unconstitutional. And the Chief Burgess, himself a former Mino, Mungo Penman of Mount Carmel, feared further violence, and he issues a proclamation to the citizens of the borough. But it's very different from Governor Pennypacker's proclamation. He calls upon the citizens of the borough to, quote, refrain from all acts of violence, commit no overt act, use no inflammatory language in public places, and to totally disregard the presence of the state constabulary to prevent possible injury or arrest of citizens. With the people, he felt, quote, the presence here of the mounted police is intended to incite violence rather than suppress it, but a power more potent than me has so ordered. The remedy was within the hands of the people. The usual quiet, peaceful order of the borough will shame those responsible for this action into withdrawing from it. But he went on to warn the state constabulary. The press called them the state constabulary. Officially, it's the Pennsylvania Department of State Police. The press would distinguish them from other policemen by calling them the state constabulary. To the workers, they would call them Cossacks and other words. But he said he warned the state constabulary against violation of private rights and morals of our community, not to ride upon the sidewalks, driving peaceable pedestrians before them while wide streets are open, not to use vulgar or profane language within hearing of our people, and to desist from insulting from their armed places of security, I guess on horseback, our women. And the proclamation concluded with the Burgess imploring the people of the community for their own protection and security to disregard those humiliations and face this crisis with the serenity which comes from lawful behavior. All right. Now, the next day, May 4th, the miners, the members of the constabulary, took two of the men they'd arrested and detained at the colliery to the local JP and preferred charges against them. The charges against one of them were immediately dropped and dismissed. The other was held for trial. The miner against whom charges were dismissed went back to Mount Carmel and was interviewed by a journalist. He was a Polish-born miner. And the journalist asked him about his captivity at Saya Colliery. And he, during his captivity at the colliery, behind the stockade, and he said, well, I was treated well, but he was invited to work and live at the colliery during the coal suspension and what everyone thought was going to be a long strike. And then in his broken English, the miner replied to the journalist, me no scab, chuck me down shaft, but me no scab, right? But nonetheless, by the end of the week, calm had returned to Mount Carmel. The injured were reported doing well in the miners' hospital in Ashland, and none of them were going to die. And in actual fact, Troop B was returned to its barracks in Wyoming, Luzerne County. And Troop C was patrolling the borough and the surrounding area. And eventually what happened was Troop C was withdrawn because, I guess, not just because calm or order had been returned, but because John Mitchell and the UMW do a deal with the anthracite operators. So the work suspension is over and no strike followed it, right? So they returned to their barracks. As I say, after... the next year in 1907, the barracks of Troop C was moved from Reading, Berks County, to Pottsville, Schuylkill County. So what did the presence of the constabulary do? You know, impress the public with the might of the state for quelling disorder? Actually, the opposite. I would say they exacerbated or the violence or provoked, you know, more violence, worse violence. The miners, the citizens, the local authorities were actually outraged by the presence, the arrival, the presence and conduct of the state constabulary. I mean, it led to 14 people being shot, right, and wounded and hospitalized. This is just one small incident that occurred in the coalfields in 1906 in the anthracite coalfields. In some ways it was atypical. In other ways, I would say it was very, very typical. It was atypical in the way, and as I say, I've never found this before. The state police made the lieutenant. I'm sure the superintendent must have torn a strip off him. That the big mistake they made was walking back into Mount Carmel on foot, going back into Mount Carmel for breakfast on foot. If they had ridden gone back on their horses and simply, tied their horses up, they could have mounted their horses and they could have dealt with that crowd easily. But they were on foot. And I've never encountered any other incidents where they're caught on foot and not mounted, it's not for nothing that the Wobblies would criticize them as sort of policing as the hoof and the club, right? The hoof, the horse and their riot stick were their best weapons. That was what they would resort to first, and that's usually what they needed. They didn't need their pistols, didn't need their rifles. But just to give you one more small example, actually, At Boston Settlement, another incident where they were policing a mine patch, a coal patch in actual fact, after the policing of Boston Settlement, a journalist influenced the lieutenant from Troop B, Wyoming, Luzerne County, about the incident. And he asked them about what do you do in terms of arresting people? And the lieutenant who was questioned said about making arrests, he said that he replied that, let me see. And he replied in the presence of more than just the journalist, no, we don't make arrests in cases of this kind. If these people don't behave, we go in and knock the hell out of them. Right, and then in addition, the reporter discovered that a sergeant from Troop B had threatened the residents that they would burn down the village of Boston Settlement and openly told the people that if there were any more disturbances, he would return and burn the place. See, what happened, the journalist recorded this, and the newspaper editor found out about it and the news and contacted Groom and then the governor. And Groom's response to being told about these conversations was Groom informed the when informed of the comments of the lieutenant and the sergeant by the editor of the newspaper, quote, he took cognizance of both of these indiscretions and excused the first on the grounds that the lieutenant had been in the regular army. In the second instance, he said the constabulary had instructions to burn down the town. So the newspaper editor passes all this information on to the governor, Governor Pennypacker. It's in his papers, you know, in the archives, the entire exchange, but nothing happened. So, you know, the sort of thing that happened at Mount Carmel, in some ways it's atypical because they're caught off their horses and they never did that again. But in other ways, what happened with their arrival, presence, and conduct was typical. Same thing happened in bituminous coal in 1906 and later. I studied an incident in Ernest, Indiana County, but there were similar events to the ones I studied in, Ernest, Indiana County. Similar events at Winbur in Somerset County. So, and in some ways, how they operated in the coalfields in 1906, it was indicative of how they would operate in anthracite in 1912, 1916, later on 1920, 1922. And just as what happened at Ernest, Indiana County, was indicative of what with the sort of thing that would happen in 1910 to 11, in the bituminous coalfields. So, I mean, in some ways, you know, this is why it appeared to contemporaries to be sort of, especially in the early years, 1906 and onwards, you know, as I say, Russia in America, Cossacks in Pennsylvania. I would argue that the state police was the in the early 1900s was a new and extreme version of an old and common form, and that's the strike-breaking government. So I'm done.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, so, I've got questions. I'm sure others have questions.
So I'll try to answer them. Yes. Oh, you know what? That's a good question. I'm not going to answer it in a detailed fashion because, to be honest, I can't remember. But the book I used at the time, I Craig Phelan's biography of John Mitchell, you might find it there, or Perry Blatt's Democratic Miners. But I think what it was and this was, I would say generally, is Mitchell was a conservative Labour leader. And rightly or wrongly, you know, leadership matters. And I think there was a lot of support in Pennsylvania for the two simultaneous strikes, and he managed to deflect that and have separate negotiations, and maybe not such a good outcome for the UMW miners as if they'd gone ahead and say, yeah, let's strike, two industry-wide strikes at one time. And that might even have stretched the efficiency of the state police, which was really represented like the enhanced capacity of the state to deal with this sort of rising working class unrest, you know. So I guess I can't answer that in detail, but that's where I would go back and look. If, you know, I could actually, if you give me your email, I can do that when I get home and I'll email you, or at least give you the references, you know. But he was a conservative Labour leader. I mean, it's really interesting. I didn't get to talk in as much detail I was like about some of the sort of origins, creation, organization, and so on. But it's interesting to me that Mitchell just tells the miners' lobby, stand aside when the bill was going through the legislature and don't oppose it, right? And the UMW at this time wasn't affiliated with the tiny Pennsylvania Federation of Labor. And who knows, if they'd have thrown their weight against what weight they had against the bill, who knows, it might not have passed. On the other hand, the state machine, the steamroller was out, you know, and maybe it would have passed anyway. But again, you know, maybe Mitchell is seeing, well, he thinks, well, possibly, yeah, a state police force would be better than the coal and iron police, you know. And of course, it was something that they regretted. I mean, as soon as the state police went on duty, they saw how they were operating, and then there's hell to pay. at the local level, the district level, the tri-district level, in anthracite and in bituminous, and they're like, how did this bill pass? You know, what was our position on this? And of course, Mitchell manages to smooth everything down, but to give the UMW credit, they then turn round, and one of the reasons the Pennsylvania Federation of Labor grew in size and in some ways influence, relatively speaking, during the 1900s and 1910s, is that the UMW affiliates with the Pennsylvania Federation of Labor. And in actual fact, Jim Mauer becomes the focal point of the campaign against the state police, and his able lieutenant is Thomas Kennedy of the UMW from the anthracite regions. And irony of irony, Thomas Kennedy in the 1930s ends up as lieutenant governor, ostensibly, you know, after the governor, in charge of the state police. But Mitchell was, there was a lot of militancy and or radicalism in the ranks of the UMW. The UMW is a fascinating, it's a fascinating topic, its history in and of itself, isn't it? But I don't know that they were always well, this might be an understatement, but I don't know that they were well served by their presidents, you know, Mitchell or Lewis or any others, you know. So it's a long answer to a short question, sorry.
Other questions? Let me hit you with one, because people are shy about raising hands, which is the bill is interesting from the point of view that it says that they are to intervene in those things where they are witnessing crimes being committed. Well, obviously, you know, riot and disorder is one of the only crimes that you can watch while it happens. I mean, you're not there normally sitting around watching unless somebody murders somebody, or you know, maybe you might be catching an arsonist in the. But it would seem to me that it's fairly obvious on its face that there's only one way that you're using a force like this, and that is to quell riot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, and the force is so, it's never seen by Labour in the progressive era as a legitimate force. You know, like sheriffs and deputies, urban police departments, the National Guard, the state militia or National Guard are. The state police is never given that legitimacy. They're in the ranks of the Pinkertons, Baldwin Phelps, Coal and Iron Police. They never get that legitimacy. And but it's a tremendous power to have, the power of the police of cities of the first class to arrest for any crime you witness, and you're defining what crime this is. Is there a crime, and which one is it? You know, so and they're responsible. The superintendent, the enlisted men are responsible to their officers. The officers are responsible to the superintendent. The superintendent is appointed simply and solely by the governor, is recommended by the governor, and the Senate confirms him. So there's no democratic accountability. It really is the instrument of the executive in Harrisburg. So, you know, what is a crowd, what is a mob or a riot is being determined, you know, I guess I would argue in like corporate boardrooms. And the Capitol building in Harrisburg or the governor's mansion, not on the ground level in places like Mount Carmel or Ernest or Bethlehem or McKees Rocks or Turtle Creek, places like that, you know. I don't know if I answered your question, really.
And the follow-up, and a lot of Phil wants to jump in on this, but in the 1913 copper strike, the troops, I mean, the basically the military that National Guard and other people that were being sent into the copper fields were already on the trains moving north, in effect, as the request was being made. Mm-hmm. For that help,
there's 67 counties in Pennsylvania, but the force of only 228 men, but they were efficient. I'm not disputing that. As you can tell, I'm not sympathetic to them at all, but they were efficient. 67 counties, 228 men, but they're organized, and the Act doesn't specify this, they're organized into four troops of, I think, 58 men each. And as you say, they can be deployed, as I say, they can be deployed in hours, and they can stay for weeks or months or years. They could rotate the troops. That's how you get to, you know, there is the strikes, especially in coal and especially in anthracite, there's this right, they're more frequent. They're larger, they're more prolonged, there's, as Mother Jones would say, plenty of drama, tension, and conflict. And, how is the state going to police these? You know, the old system of sort of system that had developed over time, sort of a ad hoc de facto system, with the counties and sheriffs and deputies, constables, maybe urban police departments, private detectives, Pinkertons, coal and iron police, a revived and reformed National Guard, but especially the conflict in the anthracite coalfields, that old system is no longer efficient enough. You know, it's seen as increasingly seen as corrupt, wasteful, just inefficient. That's what leads to the formation of the state police. And the state police take over the policing of strikes, the efficient policing of strikes. I would say strike breaking. But the coal and iron police are not abolished. They're not abolished till the 1930s. In actual fact, there were more coal and iron policemen than there were state policemen, right? And of course, one of the reasons for that is the Commonwealth is paying the tab for the state policemen. The coal corporations are paying the tab for the coal and iron police, right? But the coal and iron police continue until the 1930s. In actual fact, there's sort of like a revolving door. The personnel of the state police, they were Americans. They had to be citizens, couldn't be immigrants. They were white. They were Americans, sort of British Americans. You know, ancestors came over, colonial era, early national era, or old immigrants. Where was I going with that? And then what would happen, you see, is many of them had gone into the military, and many of them had been in the Spanish-American War, the Filipino War, some of them were the Boxer Rebellion. And then they go into the state police, but in the state police, they've got to live in the barracks and they can't get married. If they get married, they've got to resign, right? So what they do, I'm being a little bit facetious here, they're called out to coal strikes, they get to know the superintendents, you know, and they get to know the coal companies. They're called out during the strikes, and then lo and behold, they resign from the state police because they can resign any time. They're not held for two or three years the way the military is. Groom wanted that, but he wasn't allowed to do it. So they can resign. They get a job as a coal and iron policeman, and they can get married and settle down. And there was no one pay raise from 1905 to 1917. You're right? So there was, and let's face it, the nature of the work could be dangerous, no doubt about it.
I'm actually going to push Phil, hoping mm-hmm. he will react to the fact that he's written the history of the state police here in Michigan. Parallels you see, or the questions that you have, comments?
Well, the force here was pretty much based on Pennsylvania, but mm-hmm. one thing that was curious, you mentioned about they wanted to get deputized by that Sheriff John there, and I'm just wondering what reason did they want to get deputized? Didn't the act that created them give them sufficient authority, or did they also need to be deputized by the sheriff?
That's a really good question, and it's a really good point. I think this is the first time out of the barracks, right? And everything, it's being worked out. And I think the Act did give them sufficient authority, because again, I've never found another incident where they confront a crowd and they're not on their horses, right. I've never found another incident where they requested from a sheriff to be deputized. So this is a test in time, and I think Pennypacker and Groom and the officers and or the men are determined to assert their authority. And then, according to the Act, the bill, which is really short, they're meant to cooperate with local authorities. But what do you do when the local authorities don't want to cooperate with you? They don't want you there, you know. Now, in other places, you see, now in some ways, though, in the eastern part of the state, there are more Democrats in the eastern part of the state. We know Pennsylvania is such a Republican state. There are more Democrats in the east, though. And in the west, that's like if Pennsylvania was Republican, my God, western Pennsylvania was, even more Republican. And if they had the sympathy and support and cooperation of the local authorities, the sheriff and deputies or mayors or councilmen and so on, there was no problem whatsoever. But I think that they request to be deputized because this is the first time that they come to the southern coalfields and everything's being worked out. But they get such strong support from the governor and the Senate and the Assembly, not to mention the press and the coal operators themselves, that sort of falls by the wayside. I haven't found. I mean, I looked at Ernest, Indiana, Mount Carmel, Northumberland County. This was in my dissertation. Bethlehem, Northampton, McKees Rocks, Allegheny County, and then Turtle Creek and Wilkes-Barre. And I never found that again, where they would think, they would feel the need to have, to be deputized. Never found that again. And I do think that the Act did give them all the authority they needed. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but yeah.
Our statute here specifically says they have the power or authority of deputy sheriffs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we don't, we never have to get deputized.
Yeah, yeah. But and see, this is. I mean, the way that the sort of law enforcement has developed is ad hoc over time, isn't it? You know, institutions have been created. You know, some of them are very old, some of them are very new. At this time, the state police were new. And they're sort of being grafted on to the existing state. But my God, you know, as the Pennsylvania Federation of Labor said, and it's an understatement, once established, it's difficult to disestablish. In other words, it was impossible. It was impossible. There was no way. Once it went on active duty, and I think the coal operators were reassured, you know, this institution is going to act, going to defend our interests. That's it. The state machine is behind it. There's no way it was going to be repealed. And in actual fact, when the bill was finally passed, it was after it had been amended, and the coal operators, you know, the coal carrying railroads, there's only five or six of them, they actually, first of all, they were opposed to it because they wanted policemen that they could control. So they weren't going to let that bill pass. The Republican Party wouldn't have let that bill, the state machine, let that bill pass until the bill said, as far as possible, in replace of. The state police will operate as far as possible in replace of, as far as possible, not in replace of, as far as possible. And that was, and after that it's passed. So you can have your experiment, right, in this new state police force, because how did they know? They didn't know. They can't guarantee who's going to be governor, who's going to be superintendent, who's going to be the officers, right, and what its policies will be. They preferred the coal and iron police. The coal and iron police weren't as efficient, but the coal and iron police were directly in their pay. They paid their wages, but the coal and iron policemen had the authority of the state. But the coal and iron police were nothing like as efficient as the state police. I mean, as you can tell, I'm critical of the early state police, but they were a model of efficiency. You know, I would argue the Pennsylvania Federation of Labor was right. They were the best yet invented strike-breaking institution.
Well, with that, let's give Gary one more round of applause.
Thank you.